The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello and good morning to everybody from Richard Martin here in Singapore. Hope your day is successful and your weekend will be relaxing and a just reward for the rigors of the week, because they have been considerable, certainly for those invested in stocks and those of us whose mantle in life it is to describe those investments. It's been quite a roller coaster. And, of course, as all of you are aware, you get your information from the media, the mainstream press in the main, and I have gone to great lengths over the years to explain why you need to give these people a wide berth and to treat with great suspicion anything you may read. And anything you may hear or see on television. I want to talk today in some detail about how the financial media, the organs that you depend on for the news, how they're lying to you, basically. And they're simply doing nothing more than repeating the mantra of the government and its and business for whom they are the basic paid lackeys. And last week I spoke about financial journalists and how they perform, how they survive, why they do what they do. This is an extremely important aspect, of the wake-up call, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I could spend all my time talking about the scandals and Lloyd Blankfein and Goldman Sachs and Citicorp and why and these and who did what and why. It's not important to you. It's important in as much as you ask the questions. Yes, if the questions come, I will give the answers. But to me, what's much more important is having visions of you sitting down at breakfast and reading, your papers, or having some kind of a news program in the background that's explaining to you why the market did what it did and what it means and what the economy is doing and everything, and trying to get you to dissociate and to take a very jaundiced view of the things that you listen to and read, because they're going to do you harm, ladies and gentlemen. These things are bad for your financial and economic health and well-being. And the people involved are too. However credible they may seem, however much knowledge they seem to spew out, it's all very carefully nurtured and prepared for you. And these people are like five-star chefs in a high-class restaurant. They know what ingredients to put into the mix to make it palatable for you, and they know exactly what they've been told to say and what's supposed to pass for news and views and opinions. So let's just have a look and see, drill down a little bit into the background to what the financial press and media is all about. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled the vast majority of all news media in the U.S. And at the time, Ben Bagdikian was called alarmist for pointing this out in his book, The Media Monopoly. In his fourth edition, published in 1992, he wrote, and I quote, "In the U.S., fewer than two dozen of these extraordinary creatures owned and operate 90% of the mass media," end of quote. In other words, they're controlling almost all of America's newspapers, magazines, TV and radio stations, books, records, movies, videos, wire services, and photo agencies. He then predicted that eventually this number would fall to about half a dozen companies. This, of course, was greeted with skepticism at the time. But when the sixth edition of The Media Monopoly was published in 2000, the number had indeed fallen to six. And since then, there have been more mergers, and the scope has expanded to include new media like the Internet market. More than one in four Internet users in the U.S. now log on with AOL Time Warner, the world's largest media corporation. In 2004, Bagdikian's revised and expanded book, The New Media Monopoly, shows that only five huge corporations, Time Warner, Disney, Murdoch's News Corporation, Bertelsmann of Germany, and Viacom, which is formerly CBS, only those five now control most of the media industry in the U.S., with General Electric's NBC a close sixth. A massive outbreak of economic cognitive dissonance is being suppressed with wave after wave of manufactured good news. Every visibly negative bit of data is run through a media and central state assembly line to refashion it as good news and evidence that the nascent recovery is taking hold. Whatever cannot be rejiggered is simply buried or suppressed. Let's have a look at a few of the most blatant examples of this suppressed dissonance. First of all, if the economy, as they say, is recovering so strongly, that's to say a positive 3% GDP growth in the first quarter, then why are tax revenues down? The federal budget deficit hit an April record. The April deficit soared to $82.7 billion. Total revenues for April were down 7.9% from a year ago. In the 7 months of this year, corporate tax receipts are up 8.9% to $77.1 billion. Well, the same cannot be said of individual tax revenue, which is down 11.6% in the first 7 months to $500.8 billion. Through the first 7 months of the current budget year, which began on October the 1st, the deficit totals nearly $800 billion, and that is down only slightly from last year's deficit during the same period of $802 billion. Revenues total $1.2 trillion in those 7 months, down 4.5% from the same period last year. How can tax revenues be falling when the economy is growing strongly? And as for those corporate profits register biggest year-over-year gain in 25 years, as they say. Non-financial corporate profits are almost 14% of GDP before the global meltdown. In a $13 trillion economy, that's $1.8 trillion. But much of the good news in corporate America is not quite as rosy as presented. Secondly, you have rising corporate profits masking falling sales. And consider Walmart's last report, which caused the financial media to quiver in ecstasy because the retailer logged a 10% increase in profits. But behind the hype, profits rose 0.3 billion on 99 billion in sales. Walmart same-store sales drop, gross margins decline. You have to read to the very last line to get to the sobering reality. Same-store sales dropped in the U.S. and gross markets declined, and both were bad news, yet you'd never know it from the lead paragraphs and talking heads. And then you have corporate profits boosted with special charges and other accounting trickery. It takes a forensic accounting analysis of corporate filings to discern what's real and what's been juiced to boost quarterly earnings, so-called. Meanwhile, corporations are loading up on debt again. Junk bonds, which are essentially risky bets on future corporate earnings, made up the biggest share of corporate debt sales on record last year. That hardly suggests prudence on the part of the companies loading up on tens of billions of dollars of high interest debt. Load the company with debt, goose profits, cash out the big bonuses, and then let the balance sheet implode. So then, we have much of global corporate America's earnings resulting from the weak dollar. Now that boost to the bottom line has largely vanished in the collapse of the euro. Many of America's premier global companies earn most of their revenue overseas. Equipment maker Eaton, for instance, gets 55% of its sales from outside the U.S. Global companies such as Coca-Cola not only reap most of their sales overseas, they also depend on international growth to boost their profits. As the U.S. dollar has risen 25% against the euro, the U.S. multinationals plump profits in dollars. They'll take a huge hit. Indeed, American multinationals such as Caterpillar have already seen their stocks pummeled as traders realize the dollar's rise will slice their profits. And here's how the weak dollar boosted U.S. corporate profits. In mid-2008, when a U.S. company booked 100 euros in profits made overseas, that translated into $160 in profits when calculated in U.S. dollars. Now that same 100 euros in profits translates into $122, a huge reduction. And if that wasn't bad enough, America's major trading partners are headed into an epic slowdown. As the wheels fall off the credit and housing bubble in China, the global engine for commodities and manufacturing, and the credit storm takes down Europe, the world's largest trading bloc, U.S. corporate sales and profits will suffer. So then you have income inequality rising to 1929 levels. Well, if times are really indeed that good as you never cease to read and hear and watch, they're only good for the top 5% of households. The bottom 80% have seen their net worth and incomes decline. So much for trickle-down prosperity. So then, how about the U.S. households remaining mired in debt? They took on too much debt, and the consequences are still unfolding. 14% of all mortgages are delinquent or in foreclosure. And that's only the above water part of the iceberg. Banks are holding tens of thousands of loans out of foreclosure lest their insolvency become too obvious. Tens of thousands of homes are being hidden in the shadow inventory of homes which are in default, but which are not even listed for sale. Resetting the mortgage payments down a few dollars will do nothing to change the massive over-indebtedness. Home loan aid provides little help for those with other big bills to pay. So then we have another wave of mortgage resets which has yet to hit. Housing's bogus recovery, which you're hearing so much about, which it takes no effort to find listed and discussed in painful detail in any major newspaper, that recovery will dissolve like a sandcastle in a tsunami. The U.S. banking system is still rotten to the core. The list of ills in the U.S. banking industry is long indeed, but perhaps one fact reveals how little has been changed in the past few years of turmoil. U.S. commercial banks, not the investment banks, the commercial banks generated a record $22.6 billion in derivatives trading revenues in 2009. The same year that the Federal Reserve spent trillions of dollars to prop up the U.S. mortgage market and its banking sector. And while massive federal intervention staved off systemic insolvency last year, many U.S. banks remain effectively insolvent. Well, now you have the U.S. trade imbalance growing again. Though imports fell in the recession, imports rose 18% from the second quarter of 2009 to the fourth quarter. Ultimately, the trade deficit adds to the nation's indebtedness. And though the trade deficit has dropped from the 2006 peak at $800 billion, it is still on track to reach $500 billion in 2010. You know, in the end, ladies and gentlemen, economic intelligence, so-called, is essentially nothing more than propaganda. Despite the daily flood of financial and economic data, pundits, government agencies, and forecasters were caught off guard by the subprime mortgage crisis, the resulting banking crisis, and now, once again, by the European banking storm and sovereign debt crisis. Many official economic intelligence reports are of questionable forecasting value. As I've mentioned previously, federal budget projections are consistently over-rosy, and the nation's GDP was recently adjusted, so-called, euphemistically, down 37% in one fell swoop. This is the typical recurring pattern, isn't it? Good news numbers are released with much nascent recovery fanfare and then quietly revised down to statistical noise a few weeks later. Earlier this year, the Labor Department revised the nation's unemployment for December 2009 down by a staggering 1.39 million, bringing the total number of jobs lost since the start of the recession to 8.4 million. The culprit was, of course, as I've mentioned so very often on these wake-up call shows, the department's birth-death model, which creates phantom jobs every month based on the idea that thousands of small businesses are being born and hiring workers, despite little or no evidence for this hiring in the real world. With economic intelligence like this, no wonder 76% of Americans believe that the U.S. economy remains in recession. That must be sobering for the central state propaganda complex and the mainstream corporate media. All their efforts to persuade the average American that they are doing better financially have failed to suppress the evidence for economic decay, which is so abundant in the real world. Okay, this is Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you from Singapore, the wonderful state of Singapore, which we are so proud to point out is number one in the recent rankings of the ease in which it takes to do business in the world, beat out the following two or three countries by a hair, but nevertheless, Singapore is number one. All right. Well, if you would like to call in, you know the number and you know what to do. The number, again, for those who are logging on for the first time, is 888-873-4643. That is a toll-free number. And for the newly arrived Martians among you, that means you do not have to pay any money to make that call. So that's the number. It is, again, 888-873-4643. And if you would like to email the questions, you may do that. It is perfectly legal and acceptable behavior on your part. And you should email me at the following address. And the email line is open all day, so if I get an email from you, I will endeavor to deal with it right away. The email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. .com. Once again, the email address rm@gfawd.com. Now, many of you are calling me to get some information and good news about how to either make money during the current decline, or how not to lose money, or how to deal with your personal financial situations as maybe, and that number to call, the private line which comes through to me in Singapore, is a local Sarasota, Florida phone number with area code 941-441-1682. Again, the number to call me in private is 941-441-1682. too. I'm glad to take your questions, talk to you, and if I'm not here, please leave your name and phone number, and I will call you back post-haste. Right. Well, what happens when the fix is in but nothing gets fixed? Well, this is a troubling question which has vexed the financial markets for the last several days. 1 week ago, the Eurocrats amassed a $1 trillion war chest of borrowed money to fix the Greek debt crisis and stabilize the euro. Well, 7 days into the mission, the Greeks are as bankrupt as ever, and the euro has tumbled to a new four-year low. The European Central Bank, like British Petroleum, can't seem to figure out how to contain the mess they made, much less how to clean it up for good. Just like the crude gushing out of BP's underground well, Europe's sovereign debt crisis continues to gush out of control and threatens to wash up on the shores of Italy, Spain, and Portugal. 1 week is, of course, not enough time to judge the success of the ECB's $1 trillion euro defense plan, but 1 week is plenty of time to judge its failure. This $1 trillion fix did not fix anything. It merely annoyed short sellers for a couple of days and inspired enthusiastic gold buying. Rome wasn't built in a day, of course, so we shouldn't expect Athens to be rescued in a week or ever. The country's fiscal condition is beyond repair. Either Greece slips into the Mediterranean, figuratively speaking, or the euro does, or both. Borrowing $1 trillion to fight against the consequences of excess debt doesn't seem like a winning strategy. In a worst-case scenario, the ECB will exhaust its cash, credit, and credibility trying to save Greece, and will destroy the euro in the process. In the best-case scenario, the fix will persuade a few Wall Street strategists that the worst of the euro crisis is over, and will suck a few more suckers into the European sovereign debt markets before the situation gets really ugly. And you have it on record here, ladies and gentlemen. It will get ugly, one way or another. Many investors behave as if sovereign defaults are like polio, eradicated forever. These investors are half right. Polio has been eradicated. Greece may not actually default, depending on the rescue measures that come its way, but Greece is already bankrupt. The creditors to Greece should understand that history is not on their side. In fact, the creditors to every sovereign borrower should understand that history is not on their side. A recent Wall Street Journal article observes, and I quote, "While a European sovereign default has appeared inconceivable in recent history, defaults and debt reschedulings were actually a common feature of the European financial landscape throughout the 19th century and up until the end of World War II. And that comes from economists Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff. I may have more to say about those two later on. And I continue to quote, "Greece has defaulted or rescheduled its debts 5 times since gaining independence in 1829. This time is different," which was published in 2008 by these two, Reinhart and Rogoff, was recently expanded into a book. "Spain has the lead in Europe at 13 times since 1476. Germany and France have both done it 8 times, while the UK has never done it since William the Conqueror invaded in 1066. And I continue from the article. "Greece has existed in a perpetual state of default since its independence, having spent 50.6% of those years in default or rescheduling, which is easily tops in Europe. Russia is next highest with 39.1% of years spent as a bad debtor after defaulting or rescheduling 5 times. End of quote. Governments default. That's what they do. They tax. They squander the tax revenues. They default. This is the established unnatural order of the government world. The Greek crisis may be the first sovereign debt debacle of recent times, but it sure won't be the last." Oh well, in a poll released on Monday by consulting firm Alex Partners LLP, 90% of respondents predicted a significant American municipality would default on its debt before 2012. Only 63% of those professionals, however, believe that a foreign country will default in that same time period, despite the debt crisis unfolding in Europe. The survey results likely reflect that there is a willingness among countries in Europe and the Middle East to work together to avoid a debt default, while most believe it's unlikely that Washington would come to the aid of municipalities. And that's according to Peter Fitzsimmons, Alex Partners' North American president. And I quote, "There is very little appetite at the federal level to bail out local governments, and the problems in some cities are severe enough that there will probably be a default." End of quote. Well, a number of municipalities, including Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Detroit, and San Diego, have openly discussed their deep financial problems and have even contemplating filing for Chapter 9, a section of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code that governs municipal filings. Municipalities are struggling in part because widespread foreclosures and commercial property vacancies have caused property values to fall, which in turn limits how much property tax local government can collect. And that's according to Juliet Moringello, resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. And she said, and I quote, "The impact of the financial crisis has trickled up to municipalities." Well, Alex Partners, which is a Southfield, Michigan turnaround firm, polled 91 bankruptcy lawyers, bankers, and fund managers earlier this month as part of its annual survey of restructuring professionals. All right, well, we are very close to the moment of truth, which is when we take our break, but let me just tell you that U.S. fiscal policy has been going in the wrong direction for a very long time. But this year, the U.S. government declined to lay out any plan to balance its budget ever again. Based on President Obama's fiscal 2011 budget, the Congressional Budget Office, which is known as the CBO, estimates a deficit that starts at 10.3% of GDP in 2010. It's projected to narrow as the economy recovers, but will still be 5.6% in 2020. As a result, the net national debt, which is the debt held by the public, will more than double to 90% by 2020 from 40% in 2008. The current Greek deficit is now thought to be 13.6% of a far smaller GDP. Unlike America's, the Greek insolvency is not too large for an international rescue. And as sobering as the debt or the U.S. debt limits are, they are incomplete and optimistic. They do not include deficit spending resulting from the new health insurance legislation. The revenue numbers rely on increased tax rates beginning next year, resulting from the scheduled expiration of the Bush tax cuts. And as usual, they ignore the unfunded liabilities of social insurance programs, even though these benefits are officially recognized as, quote, mandatory spending when the time comes to pay them out. The feds assume a relationship between the economy and tax revenue that is divorced from reality. 6 decades of history have established one far-reaching fact that needs to be built into fiscal calculations, namely, increases in federal tax rates, particularly if targeted at the higher brackets, produce no additional revenue. And that's a very sobering truth. But for politicians, it's truly an inconvenient truth. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a break, and we'll be back in a few moments.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
This Friday on Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, and Laughter, one of the nicest, sexiest, funny, smart, and talented American icons ever, Barbie Benton. Singer, musician, comedian, Hugh Hefner's girlfriend, star of Hee-Haw, it's hard to think of something Barbie hasn't accomplished. And especially if you're an American male baby boomer, tune in. Barbie's as sweet as ever and a good friend of Dr. Diana's. That's Love, Lust, and Laughter with special guest Barbie Benton, this Friday at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Let your imagination fly. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Take a trip with me through the literary landscape of Writer's Voice. Join the tour and the conversation as we talk with writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Saturday at noon.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, we're back again, and I just wanted to draw your attention to a comment from one of the analysts that I find most illuminating. He gives me tremendous amounts of information which would otherwise be very hard to find. His name is David Rosenberg. I think I've mentioned him before. He used to be with Merrill Lynch in New York. I think he was their lead analyst. He left Merrill and is now with Glasskin Chef, which is a company out of Toronto. He is, I believe, Canadian himself. He's gone back to Canada, but has not met up with his pithy commentaries, and I take what he says very seriously. I read his daily screed, and I bring to your attention anything which is of note. And in that respect, I am here to let you know that Dave believes that we are indeed in a depression. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know me. I'm always a little bit over the top. I say things as they are, perhaps before they really are. And I always gave the date of the depression as February the 29th. I think it was a leap year. It was basically in 2007 when the day that the Chinese market fell 15% in one day. And I remember I was in New York and I was doing my wake-up call from a hotel room, and I stated at that point that I felt that that was the beginning of the depression of the century. So anyway, this is what Dave has to say. He says, and I quote, "There are classic signs, indeed, that the recession in the U.S. ended last summer, output, sales, etc., but the depression is ongoing. And the reason we say that is because real personal income, excluding handouts from the government, has barely budged. In fact, real organic personal income is nearly $500 billion lower now than it was at the peak 16 months ago, and this has never occurred before coming out of any technical recession. It is a depression. That is the trend line for household real incomes until the government comes in to top them off with handout subsidies and extended jobless benefits. The share of U.S. personal income being derived from Uncle Sam's generosity has risen above 18% for the first time ever." Well, there you have it. If Dave says it, ladies and gentlemen, you may take that to the bank. All right. Well, anybody who wants to call in, remember that we still have a phone. And as far as I know, the toll-free number still works, and the number is still 888-873-4643. Once again, the toll-free number, 888-873-4643. Well, so now let's get to some emails from you. Quite a lot this week, actually. I hope I'll have time to get through them all. But just before I do that, let me just mention, I had mentioned a new video which is making the rounds called Melt Up, which is a scaremongers video, in my opinion, about inflation, which is not to be. Again, it's called Melt Up. Give it a wide berth, ladies and gentlemen. Ignore it. It's basically trying to goose prices higher. I don't know who's behind it, but as I'm sure you know, the powers that be would like nothing better than to see a healthy dose of inflation pushing the prices up and reducing the value of all your debts, but in the end, of course, creating the kind of crisis that only comes from inflation and reduces the value of everything and ends in the most almighty bust. So we don't want to see that, and indeed we're not seeing that. We're seeing something actually much worse than that, which is deflation. I've spoken a lot about that, so I won't spend any more time on that. But anyway, that's one thing. Another thing is that I have now seen the first installment of the new show for Bill Moyers' replacement called Need to Know. It's presented by a fairly young female correspondent and a fairly young male correspondent, and they are both what I would call lightweights. In fact, the female version used to sub for Keith Olbermann before they found Rachel Maddow, my wife and I always used to remark upon how floppy and flabby the show sounded without Keith Olbermann in the hands of this lady. I don't know what her name is, I've forgotten, but basically she's now found her way onto the PBS show, the replacement show for Bill Moyers, which of course is a milquetoast performance. They never want to take a side on anything. Everything is filled with lack of direction. I don't know whether this is on the instruction of PBS, who don't want them to take a side on any issue. They just want people to, you know, get the news. And it's quite strange to me that PBS got rid of Bill Moyers and now with David Brancaccio at exactly the same time. But be that as it may, unfortunately, Need to Know is no replacement. And I'm not sure quite what is needed to be known about that show. Nothing that we saw recently seemed to be that important in terms of a social commentary, but it's a shame. It's a great pity, because there is indeed no replacement for Bill Moyers nor for David Brancaccio, and it's very sad. Very sad to see where American media have forced the real commentary of the day to go, which is totally into the internet and onto the sidelines. Also, saw the show with Lloyd Blankfein on Charlie Rose, the interview with the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Lloyd Blankfein is one of these people who, it seems, chooses every word with the utmost caution in case he should put one foot wrong, get one comma out of place. You know, it's funny, when he's asked a question, his lips formulate the beginning of a word which never comes out, and so his lips have to change direction to comply with his instantaneous change of thought. It's really quite a sight to watch. He seems like an affable enough person, but it really makes you wonder whether Goldman Sachs will ever be found guilty of anything, given the painstaking way in which they do things. I'm sure the French guy, Fabulous Fab, the trader who was dinged by the SEC, is going to have a harder time of it, but wouldn't surprise me at all to see Goldman Sachs climb out of that one. Charlie Rose is a disgrace. He came unprepared for the interview. He knows nothing, it seems, about what's going on in the financial world. He doesn't even know the difference between market makers and financial advisors. He doesn't understand, it seems, that advisors can be advising one thing and market makers who may be working, you know, hundreds of, if not thousands of miles away, may be doing something completely different. And so, of course, Blankfein was on a roll with Charlie Rose because he was explaining to him, like a five-year-old, the difference and why it was that it was indeed possible for financial advisors to be recommending something and the market makers, whose job it is to make a market for the various issues that they trade, may be doing something else. And that selling short as a market maker is as much a means to protect and hedge oneself as it is to state a given chosen direction and a favored view about the markets. And as usual, Charlie Rose would interrupt. And at one point, Blankfein, realizing he was on a roll, he started almost shouting at him. He said, stop, 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 because clearly Charlie Rose was just making a fool of himself, which he was. So it was an embarrassing and altogether most unrewarding show, because if Charlie Rose had come prepared for that interview, he could have slayed that guy Blankfein and really put him on the spot. And he missed his opportunity because he didn't prepare for the interview. And I don't know whether that's the arrogance of Charlie Rose thinking because he, Charlie Rose, is Charlie Rose, that people will just swoon and fall at his feet, or whether he's just lazy. But one way or another, it was a shame. Anyway, an email from Doris. Dear Richard, please do not mention my last name should you read this on the show. I emailed you about retirement investment questions a few months ago, and thanks to you for your advice. Since then, I took the little I had in stocks and real estate out and put it in bonds. Soon, I will take everything I have in bonds and probably will put it in a money market option I have in my retirement plan. Today, I have two options. One, I remember you said in one of your shows that money is not necessarily safe in a money market account. Could you please explain how money from a money market account can disappear? Well, I think I've explained that before. Basically, it's a function of two kinds of money market, the treasury bill money market, which is underwritten by the government, which should be safe, Doris, and the commercial money market funds based on business, which could go bankrupt, which could be unsafe and could be in danger. So beware of those. Stick to treasury bill money market funds. Two, I'm owning a property with a 6.25% interest rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage. I have 27 and a half years left on this mortgage. I would like to refinance to the current low rates to a 20 or 15-year fixed rate. Is it time to refinance or should I wait? I'm listening to all your shows. Selling is not an option for several personal reasons. Thank you for your advice, Doris. Well, Doris, if you feel that you're going to be able to afford the lower rates, by all means refinance. But you want to be sure you're going to really keep going up that for 27 and a half years, because otherwise it might not be worth it. But if you have the money and you think you're going to need to stay around for 27 and a half years or at least 10 years, let's say, then I would consider refinancing. Okay. Well, U.S. home foreclosures climbed to a record in April, ladies and gentlemen, a sign that government mortgage relief efforts have yet to turn the tide of property seizures, and that's according to a report by RealtyTrack, and I quote, right now it appears that the banks are focusing on processing the loans already in foreclosure and slowing down the initiation of new foreclosure proceedings as a way of managing inventory levels, end of quote. Rick Schager, RealtyTrack's executive vice president, said in an email, we'll probably see this trend continue for a while. Well, bank repossessions rose to 92,432 in April, up 45% from a year earlier. Irvine, California-based RealtyTrack said today in a statement, foreclosure filings, including default and auction notices, fell 2% to 333,837. One out of every 387 households received a filing. Unemployment of 9.9% and a rising percentage of homes worth less than the mortgages on them are combining to thwart a housing recovery, according to RealtyTrack. About 5 million delinquent loans will probably end up in the foreclosure process, in addition to the 1.2 homes already taken back by lenders, according to Shaga. All right, well, I had mentioned the IMD 2010 World Competitive Yearbook Rankings, in which Singapore came out number one on top for the first time. Congratulations, Singapore. Charles from New York City came in with an email saying, "Hello, Richard. From what I can gather from the sound of your voice on the wake-up call, all is well in Singapore." Well, yes, it is. Thank you very much for it, Charles. "Over the past couple of weeks, I have been unable to listen to the wake-up call and discussion group live. I did a marathon session last night and listened to the last three shows in a row, all fantastic shows as usual. Thank you for the thorough research. I see you have even resurrected Noam Chomsky. The depth and range of all the various voices you present is truly amazing. I appreciate the high level of scholarship. I'm a much better person because of it. Also, the piece you read about the woman comparing her experience in Japan to America was absolutely fantastic. Those quality of life issues are only visible to Americans who have lived outside the country. This type of behavior is precisely the type of thing I see on a daily basis in New York City. I detest it with a passion. This may be an area you want to explore more, since this is something Americans can actually see and feel right now. This realization may wake up some listeners. Thanks, Charles from New York City." Well, I hope it does, Charles. And indeed, listeners, if you wish to talk, you know, about your experiences of interacting with businesses and things that are going wrong in your lives, then we are very, very happy to listen to what you have to say, and we'd be more than pleased to give you the opportunity to do that. Part of what the show's all about is you having your say and giving us the benefit of your, you know, experiences and basic ideas about what's going on. Okay, then I got an email from Axel Perez, who's a former New Jersey school teacher, who was responding to an email that I had sent out. He is one of my recipients of my the distribution list, my email distribution list. And I had sent out what I called a daily factoid as follows. "Pelham Memorial High School in Westchester County advertised 7 teaching jobs. It has been flooded with 3,010 applications from candidates as far away as California." To which Axel responds, "To add to the employment factoid of the day, today the recently unemployed faculty of the Patterson Public School System, as well as support staff ranging from nurses to custodians, were packed into the school auditorium to meet with representatives from the state unemployment office. There were no seats available, so the staff members were standing in the aisles with gloomy faces and clenched jaws as they demanded answers from the battered, overworked state representatives. The mood was grim as colleagues exchanged phony pleasantries and suspicious stares, wondering who they will be competing with for existing job positions. The state unemployment representative stated that they would pay 60% of your gross salary with a maximum benefit of $650 a week. Also, we displaced workers qualified for a one-time $4,000 tuition payment to be used for employment retraining. The emphasis was placed on pursuing a career in the medical field. The word manufacturing was spoken not once. In addition, we are eligible for tuition waivers at state-operated colleges and universities. Since the average salary of the newly hired over 1,000-strong laid-off teachers and support staff is approximately $60,000 a year, most will receive the maximum unemployment benefits plus other related services such as tuition payments. Obviously, the costs could reach $1 million a week as we continue eliminating jobs and we are retrained to participate in the service-oriented economy that lacks job opportunities. The state representatives informed us at the meeting that there are people collecting unemployment since 2007 and that we need not be concerned about losing benefits after a 52-week period because they have been granting extensions to those who are long-term unemployed. So, where is the unemployment funding coming from if we have fewer workers contributing to the unemployment fund? We are in perpetual tilt. More benefit recipients and fewer contributors equal bankruptcy. I feel I'm aboard the Titanic, say about 100 yards before the iceberg, and we are busy switching seats for prosperity. Thank you for the wake-up call. Axel Perez, former New Jersey school teacher. Very sobering. Thank you, Axel, for that. Very interesting information from the trenches. Andrew Celsius sent me a very excellent website for those of you who might be considering leaving the United States, and it really is well worth your time, and I'd like you to write it down if you can grab a pencil and a piece of paper, and I'll give it to you in just a second. Meanwhile, before I do that, I'll give you a chance to find something to write with. I got an email, not signed, so I don't know who it's from, but certainly welcome to the show, listener, and the email goes as follows. Greetings, Richard. I am a new regular listener, receiving your broadcast through dial-up, so I'm only able to listen to archives, not live. However, I saw two economists interviewed separately yesterday on Washington Journal C-SPAN, Jamie Galbraith and Jeffrey Myron at Harvard, with a new book, A to Z of Libertarianism. I'm wondering how you see these two points of views, particularly the libertarian. I look forward to your thoughts on the archives. Well, Mr. Not Signed, or Mr. Anonymous, thank you very much for listening, and I welcome you again to the show. You are clearly new, because otherwise you would know that I do not deal in politics. It is not my forte. It bores me no end. I dislike the egos. I have no idea what a conservative believes in, or an arch-conservative, or a new conservative, or a neo-conservative, or a liberal, or a libertarian, or whatever the difference is between a liberal and a libertarian, or a flaming liberal, you know, or a watered-down conservative. So all of these things, sorry, I'm very sorry, but I am completely without words. I do not know what they are, what they do for a living, or why they even exist. Politics is nothing more than a show and an opportunity for a few people to brandish their egos, and I'm just not going to get sucked into that. And I'm putting it nicely, Mr. Not Signed or Mrs. Not Signed, and I have no energy against your email of any sort. I appreciate it, but just so you know, politics is not my thing. Anyway, let me now give you the email address of this excellent site for those of you who may be looking to leave the United States. The email address is expatfinder.com. Okay, once more, the word expatfinder, that's E-X-P-A-T-F-I-N-D-E-R, expatfinder. www.expatfinder.com. Okay? I have looked at it, and thank you, Andrew, very much for that very, very valuable piece of information, and I have looked at the site, and I'm very impressed. Okay, an email from Halina, who says, "Hello, Richard. I immigrated to the U.S. from Eastern Europe 30 years ago because I paid off my house in the New York suburbs, and I was able to retire early. Now I have a chance to listen to your program, which I'm thankful for. It would be difficult for me to emigrate anywhere, and I don't want to go back to Europe since they're in collapse. Gardening was and is my hobby, so I thought I could do it on a larger scale. I can sell my house and buy a farm in Maine with the help of my two children and be self-sustainable, not to sit in New York and wait for trouble. Do you think this is a sound idea? Thank you, Richard. Sincerely, Helena." Well, Helena, I'm not sure I understand particularly why you can't emigrate elsewhere. You don't only have to go to Europe, you know. But you don't say why it would be difficult to emigrate. You do say it would, but you don't say why. Maybe it has something to do with your family. And I certainly think that Maine might be appropriate if you want to leave the city. But I don't think that Maine will escape trouble. But at least, you know, if you are in a large garden situation, as I might say, you can certainly grow your own food and see nothing wrong with that, so could well be a sound idea. I don't think that I would buy a house, however, right now, with the proceeds of the sale of your house. I would go and rent a while and look around, make sure you know where you want to live, go and live in Maine for a while and rent somewhere, and then make sure that's really what looks like the future of your life. I do have people, I know people in Maine who enjoy it, but it is very isolated and it's not at all what you are used to. So you might just want to check it out for the appropriate nature of your choice before you plunk your money down into a farm. Meanwhile, I think you'll find that the prices of farm land will decline. And so you could be also killing two birds with one stone in that respect. Okay, Steve Kruger wrote in. I had another emailed comment that I put out, which was about Geithner, a poor man who's so ignorant and so useless that it's hard even to mention his name without wanting to throw up. But anyway, this was about Tim Geithner, the head of the Treasury. And I quoted, and I said, Geithner added that neither the U.S. nor individual states, such as the troubled California, would face some of the same challenges as Greece or Spain. It's not going to happen in the United States, he said. The United States has a much stronger recovery than most people would have expected just 3 months ago. The world economy is getting stronger, too. We've seen very strong growth in Asia, in many emerging markets. Geithner said that China seems much stronger now. Quote, their leaders have shown remarkable capacity over the last 30 years to manage through this remarkable transition. And you're seeing the U.S. is benefiting a lot from that. U.S. exports to China grew in the first quarter of this year by 50% compared to the first quarter of last year. Well, Steve felt constrained to reply and said as follows. What a king-sized pair of plums on Geithner. How does he walk? When I check out the supermarket and I see someone paying with food stamps, they usually have a blank, faraway look and a general air of sadness. With 40 million Americans waiting for their digitized state cheese, food stamps, this is more than a few challenges. This is exactly like Greece. The reason Americans are not tossing Molotov cocktails is because we can still print money and Greece can't. When that comes to an end, you'll see the same stateside. If this is a strong recovery with the Dow down 500 points in a week, I have to ask just how stupid does he think the public is? Do you think Geithner has short the market? If he is, then he's right. This is a recovery, but just for the shorts. Signed, Steve Kruger. Oh, Steve in his usual pithy way. By the way, Steve, I've not seen any rants from you lately. You're falling down on the job, my friend. Rants are what we came to know and love. And since I left the United States and came to Singapore, they've dropped off. Please rectify the situation forthwith. Don't worry, Steve, you're doing a great job. And just do whatever inspiration brings upon you to do, because basically it always comes out better that way. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are getting towards the close of the show here. I will actually next Friday, I'll be here on Monday next Friday. I think I'll be here too, and then after that it's going to be Memorial Day, so there'll be a couple of days when I will be away, but I will attempt, all things being equal, record a show for you, and I will be giving a fairly definitive view on my, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday, in a hopefully recorded show on the last of the talks that I think we will be having on whether America is indeed engaged in a pattern of self-destructive death wish behavior, which, as I as most of you know, I believe very profoundly that the degree of optimism which has characterized America over the last couple of centuries is tragically unfounded, but America has now got to deal with the fruits of a very great deal of pessimism for the next, I'm going to say generation, but probably several generations, if not definitively. When I keep reading you out these terrible deficits and debts that the country has incurred, quite gratuitously, I may add, absolutely unnecessarily, but as a result of the optimism that characterizes the country, the fact that when manufacturing left the shores of the United States, the powers that be decided to kind of reward the people with funny money and let them buy over whatever they chose to buy, what their fancy took to them to do, and of course that's culminated in all the debts that we now see today. And I think it is a downward definitive death spiral, and I will be talking about that, sort of wrapping up my theme of the moment, which has lasted much longer than I expected that it would, and hopefully then we'll move on to something else, because the original idea was that I would try to focus the discussion groups on a Sunday on a different topic each week, but the death wish topic seem to take over and take on a life of its own. So we've been dealing with that for actually several months, and I think it's time to move on. So we'll talk about it on Sunday. If you have information or interesting ideas to contribute, we would welcome your calls. And then the following Sunday, I will wrap it all up with a recorded talk. I haven't talked to my engineers about that yet, so I can't promise that that's going to be a possibility, but hopefully it will. And then the following Sunday, the Sunday after that, we'll go elsewhere. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate very, very much your time, and I wish you a wonderful weekend, and I will be back on Monday with another edition of the Wake Up Call. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.